The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
And you're very welcome along to the programme this morning. It's Donal Kavanagh standing in for Greg on the show for the last time today. Normality gets resumed on Monday, but you have me for today, and I always love doing this show on a Friday because we have the Friday panel going to introduce you to our three guests in just a moment. Just to remind you that if you want to engage with the programme, as always, we welcome your comments, we welcome your views, we welcome your perspectives on the issues we're discussing, and indeed the other issues on the day, those that are taxing you as well. You can call us on 0749 125 000. If you're outside the Donegal dialing area, it's 0035 374 9125 000. If you want to text us or WhatsApp us, it's 086 60 25 000. We're available through electronic means, email comments at highlandradio.com. You can also get us on social media at Highland Radio on X, Highland Hub on Facebook, also available on other social media channels. And you, of course, can watch the show as it unfolds live, including our Friday panel, which is all, of course, on Zoom video. You can watch that unfold on our Facebook pages and also on our YouTube channel, Highland Radio Ireland. But first of all, let's introduce you to our panel this morning, and we'll just go over to Zoom. And first of all, we will say good morning to former Independent Deputy Thomas Pringle. Thomas, a very good morning to you.
Morning, Donal. How are you?
Very well indeed. Ben Harkin, who's the chairperson of Ogra Fianna Fáil in Donegal and also an author. Ben, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Donal. Thanks for having me.
And a longtime friend of the station and the show, columnist and former editor of the Derry Journal, Pat McCart. Pat, hello.
Thank you, Donal.
Great to speak to you all, as always. And as I said, if you want to get in on this discussion, do send us your text or WhatsApp, 086 60 25 000. We're going to start with the question of Leo Varadkar and comments Leo Varadkar made last weekend. Now, he made them on the podcast Path to Power, presented by Matt Cooper. And the comments were presented as Leo Varadkar saying that we in urban areas are paying and subsidising people in rural areas. Now, I think I actually did hear the podcast, so it was a little bit more nuanced than that. But let's sort of take the whole issue. Does what Leo Varadkar said point to a new urban-rural divide that needs to be addressed? Pat McCart, I'm going to start with you.
I think it does in a strange sort of way. A couple of years back, Donald, I heard a guy who's an academic. Now, don't ask me where he was from. And he was peddling the same line that rural Ireland, you know, the fact that electricity poles had to be put in to put in service people in rural areas, cost so much and all this sort of stuff. And he was basically saying that we should all be living in towns, and that rural Ireland was costing a lot of people a lot of money and so on. But the one thing I thought about that, Donal, when you look at Donegal, and Thomas knows this better, well, a hell of a lot better than I do. We have no service, not a mile of motorway in Donegal, not an inch of railway in Donegal, public railway. If you want cancer services or heart services, you go to Dublin, go to Galway. So the urban areas are getting a hell of a lot more service than we are. So I think there's a balancing act. And I think there is this sort of thing now that there's sort of, you know, farmers are getting subsidies and all the rest of it. Donal, it's a much more, I think to use your term, it's a much more nuanced thing than Varadkar was saying. But there does seem to be this sort of idea now that we should all be living in towns.
See, the funny thing, though, from what I interpreted from what Varadkar actually said, was it was almost sympathetic toward rural Ireland, in the sense that the point he was making is he was contrasting the economy of the 1950s to the economy now. And the point he made was, the actual central point he was making, was that in the 50s, the economy was agrarian based, that what was good for the farmer and what was good for rural Ireland was good for the economy. He says now there's been a switch in the economic impetus, that the focus is now on production, the focus is now on what's happening in the towns, what's happening in the urban areas. And he says now what's good for the farmer and what's good for the rural area is not necessarily what's good for the economy.
Did he not say they got a lot of tax breaks and a lot of subsidies, farmers? He was basically sort of saying, you know, the farming community, the farmers plead poverty.
But he did, but the thing is, you see, the question I always find when you look at this is, do farmers get subsidies? Yes. Now, the question is, how do we frame that question? Do we frame it in terms of farmers get subsidies because they're necessary for various things, including food, including keeping the agricultural economy going, including ensuring that rural areas have a future, or are they getting the subsidies because they're spongers? Now, from what I heard, I don't think there was anything in what Leo Varadkar says that was suggesting farmers are getting subsidies, therefore they're sponging off urban areas, but somehow that's the way the actual debate was framed. Thomas Pringle, I want to bring you in on this, actually, because as Pat said, you know more than most about the lack of services, etc., in rural areas. I don't know, first of all, did you hear the podcast and hear the whole thing, but what was your first reaction when you heard about Leo Varadkar's comments?
Yeah, well, I didn't hear the podcast, Donal, and thankfully I don't spend any time listening to Leo Varadkar spouting on podcasts, so that's... but, yeah, look, I mean, the comments, as typical of the Dublin mindset and stuff like that there, that, you know, that the country is only, would be only what it is because of Dublin and stuff like that there, like, you know, and Ireland is a lot more than just rural-urban divide or anything like that, and it's pointless to try and divide it, to split it in such a way, and I think it serves from deflecting from the other arguments, you know, and I would ask Varadkar, like, I mean, you know, one of the biggest beneficiaries of state aid in this country is businesses and business people and stuff like that there, you know, so what are the businesses in Dublin benefiting from it, you know, and the reason that the farmers are an easy target is because it's all publicly available and it's open what in terms of CAP and EU aid and stuff like that comes to the farming community, you know, so that's very easy to take a pot shot at them, like, but if you look at how the businesses are supported and the multinationals are supported in this country, I would say they're huge beneficiaries of the state as well, like, and that should be looked at too, but the other side of it as well is, you know, urban Ireland and this urban-rural divide that they talk about, and, you know, most Donegal people wouldn't see somebody who lives on the main street in Glenties as living in rural Ireland, or somebody who lives in the and, you know, on the main street in Kilmacrenan or something like that there, or, you know, and that's our Carndonagh, and that, you know, and urban in the Irish context is basically you look at Letterkenny, Balbofey, Buncrana, possibly Donegal Town, Ballyshannon, and that's urban, as and everywhere else outside that is rural areas. And we are crucified in rural Ireland in terms of lack of investment and lack of infrastructure. And I think what we should be talking about is Ireland as a whole, and we should be, and that's what the concentration should be on, and talking about how we can benefit all our citizens.
Ben Harkin, I want to bring you in here, and I've no doubt that De Valera will be rolling in his grave knowing that we've now come to a point in Irish politics where a Fianna Fáil spokesperson is brought in almost to defend what was said by a former Fine Gael Taoiseach, because you are now the representative of the same government that he was involved in. But Ben, what's your take on what Leo Varadkar said and how it was interpreted?
Oh, well, listen, I'm not going to defend it. I thought he was way off anyway. And listen, you could see very quickly, even in his own party, the reaction against it was very swift. I think when you're the Taoiseach of the country, you know, you wear the Taoiseach, you have a responsibility after that there, I think, to maybe avoid the day-to-day politics. I think Leo Varadkar had a long history of gaffes in his political career. This is more than a gaffe, obviously. This is something, you know, I think something that was very insulting to a lot of people in rural Ireland, but...
Hi, folks. Paul McDevitt here, inviting you to join myself.
Apologies.
I think that for him, anyway, this was closer to being sort of trying to get a headline on a podcast or something like that there and trying to get invited back. I think he was probably just looking for the attention of it and the headline of it, to be honest, and I think he got it.
But if that was the case, it was a very silly thing to do, insofar as surely if he had thought about it in those terms, he would know that it would actually elicit the reaction that it did.
Yeah, but I think he knew it was sort of something controversial to say. I think he knew it was sort of going to end up in a headline out of it. You know, I think that this is... I thought, anyway, it was just something that sounded silly and irresponsible from someone that sort of was going to like the attention out of it. You know, it was very swiftly, you know, people in Fine Gael, people in Fianna Fáil, people across the political divide denounced it. I thought it was just a crazy thing to say. And I thought it was just... silly on his part, from a former Taoiseach as well, whatever, but being a former, you know, Dublin politician or something like that there, from a former Taoiseach, I thought it let a lot of people down.
One of the issues that crops up regularly in discussions about the what we'll call the urban-rural divide and the difference of life in rural areas compared to urban areas is in education. Thomas, I want to go back to you for a moment, because we heard this week that Fintra National School, which is close to your own base in Killybegs, is actually about to close down now because of a lack of pupils and a lack of numbers into the future. Four pupils at the moment, no sign of new blood coming into the school. We're now going to see a school close down in a rural area. What's your take on the Fintra situation, Thomas?
Yeah, it's very disappointing, and the school has been experiencing difficulties for a number of years in attracting students and retaining students, and that unfortunately is a symptom of the decline in population in rural areas, and that the kids aren't available to attend schools, and we see it coming to fruition with the announcement that Fintra has to close, and it's very disappointing for the area and the community, and. Unfortunately, I think it's probably, I hope not, but it's something that will become more common as well, I think, as the population declines and the population moves closer to rural towns and villages as well too. It's going to make it more difficult for schools in the countryside to maintain themselves and continue on. And bizarrely, I think the advent of the Ukrainian people coming to Ireland and stuff like that, they're headed off a lot of that with the local schools and stuff like that there for the time being. And we might see more of it come to fruition now when the Ukrainians, our numbers are going down and people are returning back to Ukraine or whatever, the schools might have difficulties again. And it's symptomatic of the urbanisation of Ireland that Leo Varadkar talks about and that he wants to see happening. And that's unfortunately what we may see more of.
And Pat McCarthy does go back, and we're going right back to one of the initial points you made in your opening contribution to us, that the comments that were made some years ago by an economist who suggested that people should be moving out of rural areas and into towns, and the imminent closure of the school in Fintra is an absolute consequence of that view.
Donald, if you look back years ago, and all years ago, my wife's from Carndonagh, and I would down there about 50 years ago. And I remember it had its own garage, it had its own bakery, it had its own laundromat. There are no garages now in Carndonagh. Everybody goes to shopping either in Derry or to Letterkenny. And you look at the same places like Kilmacrenan, as Thomas mentioned earlier, Glenties. They used to have their own garda stations, they used to have their own libraries, they used to have all their. Now everybody travels somewhere else to get there. You know, everything's been centralised. And I think Varadkar says urban areas, we're the people who pay the bills. So I think basically what's happening, we are becoming, rural Ireland is dead and gone. Of course, the other side of the story, Donald, is what were the second biggest exporters of computer software in the world? The days of farming and fishing seem to be behind us.
Mm. Ben Harkin, as someone who's based in a what we'll call a rural part of Donegal, your take on this? Do you think rural areas are under threat?
I think the main threat to rural areas is the fact that, I suppose, when young people leave, whether they're going to college and that, or whether they're going to work in Dublin, it's just very, very difficult for them to get a place to live in and to set up their life in rural areas, and that's the problem. You know, if you have to set up your life in Dublin, it's very difficult then to come back to whether it's Tiernan or Glenties or wherever else, and set up your life. And that's the big problem, that people just can't get their life started in rural areas.
And it brings in the whole issue then of organisations like the GAA. And I think there's in many ways an argument to be made here that one of the key things that's keeping rural communities together is the GAA, because even though there are these pressures, you've still got places like Termin, you've still got places like Glenties, like Ardra and Gwydor that are putting forward really strong GAA teams. And it's clear that people are either staying within their community or they're coming up every week for training and coming up every week to play, because we've still got rural areas of Donegal putting forward really, really strong GAA teams. And it maybe raises a question, if it wasn't for the GAA, what would rural Ireland really be like?
Well, it's a massive part of the community, and it is that thing of the people come back every weekend to play in the GAA. But yeah, it is the problem if they can't be based here. But yeah, only for the GAA, it's probably that for a lot of places, you know, when, you know, Pat was saying there about places that closed down, the GAA in a lot of villages might be the only thing that's still there, you know. The only thing that's sort of still busy during the week might be the GAA pitch and the training facilities and that. So, but listen, that's probably, we're very lucky in Donegal that we have a strong culture around that and that it keeps our young people involved. It's something that the GAA are very aware of, obviously, with their demographics survey, and it's a massive concern for them, the threat to the GAA across the west coast of Ireland as well.
And long may that remain the case. A caller says Leo Varadkar never had to do a day's work in his life. He's had a pampered life. Now look, I'm not here to defend Leo Varadkar, but I don't think anyone ever became a fully qualified doctor by having a pampered life. And I don't think any qualified doctor never did a day's work in their life. It's a hell of a hard job to become a qualified doctor. What has happened in his political career, of course, is another question. Connor says, great job, Donal. You've defended Leo brilliantly. Nobody mentioned his interview with Ryan Tuberty, which wasn't great either. Now, I didn't hear the interview with Ryan Tuberty, but I did, as it happens, hear the podcast interview. I'm not defending anybody. I'm here to put points to a panel. And the panel have, I think, quite expertly and quite comprehensively responded to those comments. Connor says, urban areas rely on rural areas for the most basic need for existence. Look at the big plan to pump water from the Shannon to Dublin. Fair point. Now, I want to talk about, we're moving on, but sort of staying in the same slight bailiwick, because we were talking about rural services, and there's been a big debate this week about where a new bus station in Letterkenny should be. Now, and I'm sure that doesn't mean an awful lot in Killybegs or wherever, but it points to a wider issue, and it's this. I've been covering Donegal County Council meetings now for in excess of 35 years, and I can tell you, back in 1990, as is the case now, there were discussions about lack of bus stops, lack of bus shelters, lack of basic facilities for people waiting for buses right across Donegal. And the fact that we're still talking about the fact that the main bus stop for private buses and coaches in Letterkenny doesn't even have seats, never mind access to a toilet, it points to a general transport infrastructure right across Donegal that's lacking. Thomas Pringle, in terms of bus services, Letterkenny has pretty much nothing outside of the bus Erin station. I mean, is it any better in Killybegs?
I mean, we wouldn't expect to have the same level of services as Letterkenny would have. But, you know, I think it's something that's really needs to happen, and there is a need for a main bus centre, bus station in Letterkenny. You know, and particularly with the proliferation of buses and bus journeys now as well too. Like, I mean, I think it's vitally important. You know, I know it's not the same, but in Donegal Town, they're looking at relocating the bus stop in Donegal Town as well. And I remember seeing the figure that there's 90 bus movements in Donegal Town at that bus, at the current bus stop where it is on the Diamond every day. And that's just the public services, not to mention tour buses and stuff like that there. So that's a massive amount of infrastructure. So you can imagine Letterkenny would be probably a multiple of that as well, too. And, you know, so there is a need for this to be there, and it's vital in infrastructure, you know, and I think it needs to be done and dusted rather than talked about for another 20, 30 years or whatever. And I think that it needs to happen again. And I think bus stations are going to become more important as well, because as we hopefully the rural bus services can roll out a lot more and be more available to people. People will make that decision and use those services, and we have to make the facilities available for them.
I have to say, I do have a view personally that the local link transport service that we've seen proliferate over the course of the past 10 years, I think that's arguably been one of the biggest success stories in Donegal in terms of infrastructural investment. Certainly in Letterkenny, you see multiple local link buses every time you go out walking, and that wasn't the case even 5 years ago. So local link, I think, in fairness to those behind it has been a huge success.
Yeah, it has been, and I think it's hugely more potential as well. It can be done to it, but that needs you need services available to that as well. You know, you need the bus stops, you need the bus stations, you need the destinations for them, and you need the link into national services as well too, because people should be able to use a local link to go travel from, say, Falkara to Dublin, and it should tie in with the national services, and they shouldn't have to walk across Letterkenny or walk across a town to get to the national route. They should be able to just get in a bus station and see that happen, and I think that's vitally important.
Ben Harkin, I'm sure you've spent a fair portion of your time over the years on buses and waiting for buses. In terms of facilities, Donegal, how does it stack up?
Well, I suppose when I was in college in Belfast, I would have been either getting the bus up, I suppose, from Letterkenny, or else getting the train up from Derry. Listen, I'd have to agree on the local link. I think the fact that we know that because we need a new bus stop, that the local link has been a success because more people are using buses. There's just more demand for it. I think last year there were 7 million passenger journeys on local link buses. I know people that, you know, get into work in that from Annagry into Letterkenny and that on it. It's a great success, but I suppose with public transport, you want it to be easy to use, you want people to feel comfortable using it. I think the fact that we have a big facility there that's just for bus air and buses, to me, doesn't make any sense when you have, you know, buses going an equally long journey from sort of private operators, and they're all sort of in the one area. It doesn't make any sense to me. It's a massive help for infrastructure in Donegal. I think definitely, can we link up with national services? Can we link up even with the likes of that there, you know, Derry and stuff like that there, where the train is, could also be an opportunity.
Pat McCart, I want to go to you because one of the classic videos of old Donegal that's available on YouTube features a very, very young cub reporter called Pat McCart sitting on a bus making a journey across Donegal, and it wasn't today or yesterday that was shot. The bus services have changed very much since then.
Certainly, Donald. By the way, Donald, you're probably actually triggered someone in my brain. Every Monday when I was working for the Dairy People, and that was 1975, that's how long ago that was. It used to be sent down to West Donegal, down by Fallcarragh, down to Gidower. The bus left at about 9 o'clock in the morning, and the next one back was about 6 o'clock in the evening. So when you're finished for about 2 hours, you had about 7 hours to spend doing nothing with your feet up on a desk or something. So the service is atrocious. But Donald, if you look, I had two or three brothers living over the years in Sligo, and there's a real town bus service in Sligo. I think there's three areas, and it's their service, a bus service every hour. Try getting through Letterkenny. Letterkenny is now just gridlocked, non-stop. And I'm boring myself even saying this because everybody's been saying it for years. But like, remember, I think at the early part of this month, there was an incident where unfortunate, very, very unfortunate, actually, a lady lost her life at
Yes.
the roundabout. And Letterkenny came to almost a standstill. Letterkenny, somebody seriously needs to look about public transport so they can take so many cars off the road. Donald, at any time in Letterkenny, there must be 10, 15,000 cars sitting in gridlock. And the impact on the environment must be unbelievable. The air quality must be unbelievable. And, you know, even the waste of money. And Donald, I was down the main street with my brother the other day for the first time in a long time. There seemed to be a number of shops closing on the main street because people can't get parking and so on. So the implications of all this are I would say, quite severe. So the powers that be really should need or should really look at providing an adequate transport system. By the way, the final point, Donald, if you're going through Sligo from Donegal and you're heading towards Mayo or Galway, you can get through Sligo in 10 or 15 minutes, no bother whatsoever. Try getting through Letterkenny on a Friday evening when you come as far as the Manor roundabout.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are longer term plans, as we know. Let's say the magic words 10T, which is going to be the salvation to all our problems. But we're not going to see anything really constructively happen with the 10T before the mid 1930s, it seems. It's a very fair point, Pat. A caller says it's embarrassing that Letterkenny lacks a modern integrated transport hub for all providers, so much for the fastest growing town when we can't provide the basics. Another caller says I passed Letterkenny bus pull in stop last night and there were four buses blocking the way of traffic. A little more management of their behaviour by Gardaí might solve a lot of the issues there. Now, yeah, there are certainly issues in terms of the gridlock there, but even one of the things, the basic things we're talking about is if you are getting a non-bus errand bus in Letterkenny, and there is a bus errand bus station there which has basic facilities, that's just across the road, but if you're getting one of the private coaches, and there are many, or if you're getting one of the local link services, what you have is, if you're lucky and you're one of the first 10 people to get there, there is a wall you can sit on. And apart from that, there is a shelter under which maybe 7 or 8 people can stand. There is not one single official seat. And if you're wondering about a toilet or any form of comfort stop, you can absolutely forget it. On the Rural Ireland issue, and Leo Varadkar, a caller, says there's no doubt his remarks were deeply misguided. Even his own party colleagues in rural constituencies were concerned over the damage these comments did to the party's rural vote. I want to read you a comment, actually, that came in from a listener. It says that the NSPCA are having their big launch at Boswell's Hotel in Dublin next Wednesday, having closed our animal welfare centre in Ballyar and spent millions on other centres in Longford, Cork, Wicklow and Dublin. Will our TDs protest as the launch is near the Dáil Animal Welfare in Donegal has been set back 50 years? I want to put that very briefly actually to the panel. Thomas Pringle, you'll have seen your fair share of protests outside the Dáil over the years. Is this an issue with the launch in Boswell's that people in Donegal should be looking at making their voices heard at?
Well, I think if it's something that people feel very strongly about, yes, they should. I'm not 100% sure in relation to whether how much support there would be for something like that. That's the issue, and sometimes it's better to not to protest if you're not going to have big enough numbers there as well, too. Like, and but the animal welfare certainly is something that needs to be done, and to close the shelter or the in Donegal is step back, I think, and I don't know how things are going to be dealt with in the future in relation to it.
Ben Harkin, is this a fait accompli, or do you believe that perhaps a protest now could have some bearing on the NSPCA's future plans for Donegal?
It wasn't a thing, to be honest, that I was massed up to speed on.
Yeah.
I suppose it's first heard about, so I don't know if there's a massive momentum behind it. I'd say, I suppose, like Thomas says there, if there isn't, sometimes a big crowd can kind of nearly take the momentum out of it. A push for something for protesting, but it'll be interesting to see next week if there is a crowd for it.
Yeah, and Pat McCart, is this one of these cases where a story is big for a while and then it sort of falls off the front page, it falls out of the coverage on air, and perhaps people aren't thinking about this as much as they were perhaps 8, 9 months ago when it was a huge story?
Absolutely, Donald. In fact, about 10 years ago we were walking down at Inch Level and we came across this dog and was obviously dying, and somebody had dumped it, and we came my wife sent me up and we got a tin of food for it and all the rest, and we tried to get in contact with Donegal Pet Rescue, and we discovered that weekend Donegal Pet Rescue closed, so we've had a dog for 10 years that we picked up on a side of the road. So
well,
it is an issue.
That was one lucky dog. I want to move on, and I want to talk about cross-border education, particularly in third level, because we've heard this week about the potential loss of over 100 jobs at Ulster University's McGee campus and 450 jobs across UU's four campuses in Northern Ireland. Now, we do know there's been huge cross-border cooperation, driven largely actually by Paul Hannigan, who was the president of the then LYIT before ATU came into existence, and Paul now is a vice president in charge of the Letterkenny campus, but also very much engaged with the cross-border education. However, if we're talking about huge financial shortfalls and job losses at the University of Ulster, is that going to have an impact on the cross-border education cooperation? Pat, I want to stay with you on this one as a man who has vast experience working on both sides of the border and having spent a lot of time, obviously, in Derry as editor of the Journal and covering stories about the need to expand McGee and expand university status within the city. Is this something that gives you cause for concern?
Don't I think it should give us all cause for concern. Basically, the University of Ulster people spent about $360 million on a big, fancy new set of buildings in Belfast. They've so overspent, and because of other factors coming into play, they're not getting in a lot of money. They're talking about roughly 100 job losses, 100 plus job losses at McGee. They were talking about expanding McGee in coming years. That's not going to happen. They can, you know, John, I was going to use a rude word, but they can claim all day they're going to do this, going to do that. It's not going to happen. And the whole thing to this thing, Donald, there used to be this talk about a Belfast-Dublin economic corridor. There should be a Derry-Letterkenny economic corridor.
Well, there is. It's called the Northwest Gateway, apparently. It exists.
Donald, it's,
notionally.
Thank you. I was trying to think of a word. That's exactly it. It's a notion. It's not reality. And Donald, Letterkenny and Derry, McGee and ATU should be working together. We could offer massive, it's more than the sum of the parts. If the two places got together, we could expand exponentially, offer courses right, left and centre. And by the way, Derry has the lowest disposable income in the north. Donegal has the lowest disposable income in the south. So is anybody seriously telling me that an alignment of McGee and the ATU would not benefit every which way? The whole thing about nursing, about the veterinary school, about medicine, about everything, it would boost the whole place. So Donald, anybody that says that this doesn't affect us here in the south, they're kidding.
Ben Harkin, as you alluded to earlier, you went to college in Belfast, and I suspect, I don't want to make presumptions. No, I know you were in college a lot more recently than any of the other three of us were. What's your take on this?
Someone that still feels like a good while ago. Listen, it's a massive concern for Donegal. You know, I was reading there, I think in 2024, out of all the students from the Republic that went to, you know, either Ulster University or went to Queen's, 40% of them were from Donegal. So anything that impacts Queen's, anything that impacts Ulster University, is bad for Donegal. I think that, listen, they're sort of trying to say that this deficit, I think they're going to run a 20 million deficit this year, they're going to run a 25 million euro deficit next year. They're saying that it's because of a fall in international student revenue. That's about 6 million, I think, of it that they're expecting. So there's obvious concerns, mismanagement probably, you could say, maybe on this Belfast campus as well. But it's a real problem. I think we've had a great success in Donegal with the ATU, and you know that might have to end up picking up sort of the slack, picking up if there's courses that are going to be dropped out of McGee. But definitely, you know, when we chat about a Northwest corridor and that, the fact that connecting between the ATU, between Ulster University, between Queen's, we have three top class, third level institutions in the North and Donegal as well, and it's the fact that they're not linked up more is crazy.
Thomas Pringle, ATU, of course, have a campus in Killybegs on your own doorstep. In terms of the potential for growth in Killybegs, it's huge. And there's no doubt that linkages with Ulster University and cross-border focuses could only be to the benefit of Killybegs. Are you fearful that this is a potential that could go unrealised because of what's happening at UU?
Yeah, I think it's something that we should all be concerned about in Donegal, because, you know, and Pat outlined it there too as well. Like, Derry is suffering with Belfast the same way as we are suffering with Dublin. Basically, the focus is all on the capital and on the east and the north in terms of Belfast gets all the focus in terms of funding, and Derry is left behind. And Dublin gets all the focus in terms of funding, and Donegal gets left behind. So we should all be concerned about this, and the potential for the college, both colleges, to grow and develop is huge, and should be. The potential should be recognised for the whole Northwest area as well too, and you know, and we had to fight in Killybegs to make sure that the college would stay here and still be here, and now it's going to be an integral part of the ATU, which is important, and we should see the same fight go on for Derry as well too. I mean, McGee has always suffered in terms of the north, in terms of how it develops, and the time needs to take place now where that has got over and it actually developed for the good of everybody and for the good of the whole country as well. Do you think that's very important?
Traditionally, the college in Killybegs would have been associated with catering, with hotel work, with hospitality management, etc. There is potential for so much more, and there are plans for so much more courses and more mainstream courses to be offered in Killybegs, and for Killybegs to be made a campus that people will go to, not just for one niche area, but for many areas. Is that being properly recognised, or do you believe Killybegs is still being treated very much as the sort of poor relation of Letterkenny?
No, I think the advent of ATU, Atlantic Technical University, has made a big difference in terms of the standing of Killybegs, and I think that, but it still needs to be grown and developed on, and it's at the early stages. There is some rollout of apprenticeship courses and stuff like that are taking place as well too, which Killybegs is ideally placed for, with the industry around the area and that as well too. And it is true that the traditional cert college and the traditional in terms of cooking and chefing and hotel management and stuff like that is changing and becoming a lesser part, or a smaller part of the overall offering of the college, but it does have to be managed and be allowed to continue to grow and support it over the next number of years to become an integral part of the infrastructure, and that's vitally important, and so that should hopefully continue. And I think the Atlantic Technical University recognises that, and but you know, it's like everything, we need to be supported nationally from the government to ensure that those things can continue and grow as well.
Going to take a short break. Before we do, just a few of your comments. Caller says Donald Varadkar did have a pampered life. His dad was wealthy. He told young people who didn't have a deposit for a home to get it from their parents, an arrogance beyond belief. All towns are the same at certain times, and as for getting parked, there is plenty. People just don't want to walk. That's the problem, Caller says. I'm a bus driver. The bus stop is terrible. Nowhere for buses to park. If you needed to drop off, then have to drive away to find somewhere to park and then try and get back there through the traffic and pick up. It's an accident that will inevitably happen, says a caller. In Athlone last week, similar to Letterkenny, 22,000 population, 7 big hotels, high-tech industry, streets probably narrower than Letterkenny, but traffic moves freely due to a bypass. 12 e-buses provide local transport, a lot of pedestrian zones with people dining outside. Athlone used to be a nightmare to drive through, but good planning and investment has improved life for everyone there. And the caller says, when you're in a PAYE system, it doesn't matter where one lives. We all have to pay equal taxes. So let's go back to our panel. Thomas Pringle, former independent Dáil deputy. Ben Harkin, who's the chairperson of Ugra Fianna Fáil in Donegal and an author. And Pat McCart, columnist and former editor with the Derry Journal. I want to talk about social media and ask the question, should social media platforms be legally and financially liable for the monetized hate generated when their algorithms promote viral clips that lead to the targeted harassment of female and minority politicians. Let's make a comparison, because Taoiseach Micheál Martin made a very similar comment about the tricolour being exploited to a comment made by Senator Eileen Flynn. Yet he didn't face a fraction of the personal vitriol and horrendous commentary that she received online. Is that because of his office, or is it because of her identity? And I want to go to you, Ben Harkin, because we hear more and more, and we see more and more instances in which it seems that female politicians online and elsewhere are being targeted, for want of a better word.
Yeah, it's terrible. I don't know, like, when I started using social media, it was probably a very positive thing, and it seemed like a great thing to connect with people. Now it's just unbelievably negative. Why anyone would put themselves forward on it, you know, it's beggar's belief. I think the big thing for me is, no matter sort of what politician or across the political divide people put something up, the comments and the hate that's under it, 99% of it is these anonymous accounts. And to me, I think that's just unacceptable, the fact that sort of people can have anonymous accounts and make money off, whether it's, you know, just saying terrible things, whether it's just sort of spreading rumours, you know, AI-generated photos and that. To me, it's crazy. I think that the fact that social media are encouraging this, because they know what it drives clicks, they know what it drives money for themselves and then for the users. Something's just definitely broken, I think, in that sort of social contract of social media. I think that if you're going to make money off social media, I think you have to have your name on it. It has to be linked up with an ID or something like that there, because it's just really terrible. I think some of the things that are up by people and the abuse that people face.
Ultimately, though, should Meta or whoever, whatever platform it happens to be, should they be responsible? I'm going to give you an example. Now, this would not happen in a million years, but if you were to say something libelous right now, yep, Highland Radio is held responsible. Highland Radio is deemed to have published that comment. And if we go, Ben Harkin said it, we didn't, that is not a defence. Highland Radio said it, Highland Radio published it, Highland Radio is responsible for it. Should the same be the case for social media companies?
Well, I don't know, should the same be the case, or is the fact that the libel laws in Ireland are a bit ridiculous, and the fact that obviously I could say something on Highland Radio and Highland Radio become responsible for something?
But
like
in the just, law, we published, you know, it.
That's a crazy rule in and of itself. But yeah, I think it's the fact that social media companies have algorithms that they know promote this kind of stuff. And that's the crazy thing. I think anyway, if users are to get money or to get paid for their views, for their clicks on social media, then they should have to have their name beside it. You shouldn't be allowed to have anonymous accounts that can sort of just drive this hatred under, you know, people's posts and then get paid for it. It's just crazy.
Thomas Pringle, you worked closely with Eileen Flynn, and she's a very good personal friend of yours. You must have been particularly horrified by what you saw over the past number of days.
Yeah, it's shocking, and the pylon that has been taking place. And shocking, but probably not really surprising, because it is the way social media works. And I think the example you gave, Donal, there was very good. And it's why should it be different for social media companies than it is for Highland Radio or any of the newspapers or anything they got there? Because it is their vehicle that allows this to happen. But the reality is that they're not going to be made accountable. The government has made that clear, but it is the way they make their money, and the person that makes the comment might be making money out of it as well, but also the social media company is making money out of it by the engagement, and that's what they're actively pursuing. And I mean, it's shocking the amount of vitriol that you see on all the social media, and it's all being promoted and being bombarded. And the thing about it is too, is that if you're somebody that clicks as a like or looks at that, then the social media company decides that you like all that kind of stuff, so they'll bombard you with even more of it. So very quickly your whole stream then becomes all this kind of stuff, and you don't see anything else, and you get into this world then and you think that's what all that people are talking about, and it drives that completely. And that is the companies are making a decision that happens, and they are producing the algorithms that allow that to happen. And I think the companies need to be made responsible for that, but unfortunately Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael won't do that, and that's for sure.
Pat McCart, going to finish with you on this one. You spent your life in journalism. You spent much of it as an editor. You had to watch out for this sort of stuff all the time. You had to be ultra careful with what you published. It seems others don't have to have the same level of care.
No, no, it's unbelievable. You know, I think the problem is international or global. These big companies are multinational, and nobody seems to be, they're not accountable to anyone. Yet if they were doing it in Ireland, Donald, I remember getting involved in legal action on a couple of occasions where, you know, we were the defendants because of things we said. Like, and you've just pointed out to Ben about the fact that if you said something or Ben said something, that we would be responsible, you'd be responsible. There's no responsibility. These big companies are getting almost away with murder. But Donald, I think as a Eileen Flynn, she said she's taking 15, I think she said there's 15 texts or whatever it is she got that she's taking to the Gardaí. They're so severe. They're so so hateful and so on. And a simple example, done last week, I met a farmer who told me that he believed that climate change is now so severe that something needs to be done. I put that up on social media. You should have seen the pylon. I was told, Pat, you should get out more often. I was told, do you still believe in Santa Claus and all the rest? There seemed to be a group, you know, and I'm just following it. If you say COVID was such and such, they'll say, oh, you're an idiot. You know, it was set up by people. And it all seems to be coming from a sort of almost American Trump group of people that are very right-wing, who also took over a lot of the protests, you know, the very, very legitimate protests about the fuel thing. But there was a lot of this sort of waving the flag, which I find very strange. It's almost if it's organised.
Yeah, it is certainly a worrying one. And also, and there is that contrast that Eileen Flynn got a level of vitriol, it seems, online that Micheál Martin didn't. And it does beg the question, is it because she's a woman? Is it because she's from the traveller community? Is it because of who she is as compared to who he is?
Yeah, that's it. Donal, it is because Eileen's a woman. And even you see, I see comments and that they're from Fianna Fáil women TDs and Fine Gael women TDs. They get far more attacks and stuff like that there than their male counterparts do. And that's obviously orchestrated and driven by people in charge of these accounts and facilitated by the social media companies as well. And then Eileen is a traveller too, which is another part of Irish society that will be attacked at every turnaround as well. And, you know, We need to protect people against this kind of stuff, and that means taking on the social media companies, and that isn't going to happen in Ireland at the minute when you consider the social media companies and the contribution they make to corporation tax in the country. So we'll hear all the politicians dancing on pinheads not to talk about the algorithms and what they're doing, but it's the social media companies that actually generate the algorithms, and they create them, and that's what facilitates this kind of attacks on people as well.
And there we leave it. Thomas Pringle, Ben Harkin, Pat McCart. I always say when I get to do this programme on a Friday, the Friday panel is the shortest hour of the week. A wonderful conversation. Thank you, all three of you, for taking part. If you were listening to Lee on the Naughty Alarm Clock this morning, you'll know that Rita Bradley in Ballinfad Trenta is a very popular lady today. It's her 99th birthday, and a very happy birthday, Rita, from your three grandchildren in London, Niall, Hugh and Lyndon, and their partners, and your three great-grandchildren as well. Wishing Rita Bradley a very happy and blessed 99th birthday. This lady is such a beautiful person, both inside and out. That one from John and Eileen. And happy birthday to a lovely lady, Rita Bradley, and that's from Gary and all the staff at Classic Blinds, and so say all of us. BNS Credit Union in Ballybuffet are hosting a Boil the Kettle event this morning from 11 until 1 in support of Relay for Life. Call in for a cup of some lovely treats and a great cause. All support for this deserving charity is truly appreciated. Glad to give that. That's BNS Credit Union in Ballybuffet. That event taking place from 11 until 1 today. An issue that's been highlighted a number of times with regards to health coverage in Letterkenny is that of the lack of neurological services, particularly in terms of diagnosis and treatment for conditions such as Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis and epilepsy. And indeed, the Neurological Alliance of Ireland some time ago identified areas where there are gaps, and Letterkenny, as I recall, was one of those areas. Now, we're joined on the line by the Chief Executive of the Neurological Alliance of Ireland, Magdalene Rogers. Magdalene, a very good morning to you.
Morning, Donald.
In terms of the gaps in service across the country, as I say, my recollection is Letterkenny was one of the areas highlighted as a hospital and an area in need of concern. Has anything happened since the publication of that some time ago to suggest the situation is any better here or elsewhere in the country?
So, Donal, I have a slightly better good news story for the Northwest this morning, in that we did, as you recall so well, we did campaign for a consultant neurology post for Letterkenny a couple of years ago. Now, that campaign was successful thanks to the support of your listeners. Post is a locum in that post at the moment, and the post is being appointed. So that is very positive. Now, there will be, a need for further investment in Letterkenny Hospital. There are two neurologists recommended for Letterkenny in the longer term. But I suppose it is a positive story that that appointment has been progressed in Letterkenny. However, what we saw with the report that was published this week, we are still seeing significant issues in other hospitals. And I suppose relating back to Letterkenny, a lot of people, they can be seen by a neurologist in Letterkenny, but a lot of the tests and a lot of the follow-up they would need is still based in the likes of Sligo Hospital. And that's where we're seeing the gaps from the research that was published this week. So gaps in services like speech and language therapy, neuropsychology, things like access to a dietitian. The Northwest would still be very underserved when it comes to accessing those services, what we call a multidisciplinary team for people with neurological conditions. So it feels like we've got on the first rung of the ladder with the appointment of a neurologist in Letterkenny, but there is a whole suite of wraparound services that people with neurological conditions need. And that is where we need to focus efforts in the coming months and years, so that people in the Northwest can get the same level of service that is available in larger population centres.
And presumably then we're still at the point where a large number of people, once the issue is identified by that professional now in place, as you say, in Letterkenny, in order to avail of services and backup, that's when they're probably still going to have to travel to Sligo and potentially even to Galway.
Exactly. And we still have a situation, you know, as I say, I know that appointment is progressing for the neurologist in Letterkenny. We still have a situation where there's over 1,700 people on waiting lists for neurology across the Northwest. So all of this is still taking time to drill through to benefit patients. And as I say, what we're seeing then is those gaps in those ongoing services. Sligo, Galway critically need to be resourced to provide that full neurology service for the Northwest. It is great that there is going to be a proper satellite service for Letterkenny. That has been critically needed, and that's been in report after report. And finally, there is some headway on getting that established. But the Northwest needs to be in ways self-sufficient in neurology that it really isn't when it's compared to other areas of the country. As I say, over 1,700 people still on waiting lists for neurology. And the hub services in the likes of Galway and Sligo nowhere near where they should be in terms of things like speech and language therapy, dedicated neuropsychology, dietitian services. People having to travel outside of the region for these services are just not getting the same level of services in other parts of the country.
And the reality too is,
I suppose the takeaway.
The reality too is for every person that has to travel from Donegal to Sligo or to Galway to avail of, be it speech and language or whatever, that's one less place available for those in Sligo and those in Galway. And I've no doubt the demand for these services in Sligo and Galway already outstrips the level of resources available to meet that demand. So what you're doing is you're taking people from Donegal and sending them to an area that's already oversubscribed and already under huge demand. So the more you can actually provide in Letterkenny, you're not only taking the pressure off people locally that now don't have to travel, you're also taking the pressure off people in Sligo and taking the pressure off people in Galway. So I'm sure those in Sligo and Galway would love to see more services available in Letterkenny, because it's going to take the pressure off them.
Exactly, exactly. And what we need to see fundamentally is we need to see a proper hub developed in Galway and Sligo, so that in the northwest, so that the whole movement is towards a hub and spoke for neurology. And that's why we published this report this week saying, yes, there is absolutely a need, but we need to have a baseline of service provision in the areas outside Dublin. We need the likes of Galway, Sligo, Letterkenny to be developed as neurology centres. Letterkenny is a satellite neurology centre for Sligo, but Sligo needs to be developed to a level where it can provide support to patients travelling from Donegal, and also that when people are seen by the visiting neurologist in Letterkenny, if they need complex care, if they need additional diagnostic tests, that Sligo is properly resourced as a centre in the northwest to provide those services to people.
What next in terms of the campaign to have the issues in this report taken on board by government and, more importantly, actioned?
So we welcome the government's commitment to that hub and spoke model, and that would see, that's been worked on at the moment, should be published in the coming months. So, as I say, that's why we brought out our report, was to inform the hub and spoke model and to provide that, I suppose, that insight into what are the gaps across the country. So we really want to see that model published, but we also want to see that resourcing of regional services. We're still seeing 10 years on from the publication of the model of care for neurology in Ireland, we're still seeing this week such significant gaps around the country. And it feels like we're going at this piecemeal, putting a neurologist in here, in place here, and a neurologist in place there. What there needs to be is a root and branch investment in neurology services in the country to bring them up to where they need to be, to provide that baseline for regional hubs. And as I say, there's nothing new here. There was a report published by the Sale to Hospital Group in 2024 that recommended all of this, that Galway, Letterkenny and Sligo would all be resourced to provide a proper integrated neurology service for the Northwest. And that's what we're calling for with the publication of our report this week, is for that report to be implemented, for all of the reports and policy to be implemented, so the people in the Northwest are getting the same level of neurology service as other areas of the country.
And to borrow a phrase from an old political campaign, when it comes to services in Letterkenny, a lot done, more to do.
Completely. We've got, as I say, we're halfway there with the neurologist that's in place. There is another post recommended for Letterkenny in that Sale to report. And as I say, what we need are services, a root and branch for neurology services in the Northwest to be where they need to be, so that people are not travelling huge distances to Dublin or to other population centres for access things like speech and language therapy, physiotherapy, neuropsychology, because this is not like ordinary speech and language therapy in the community, which has a range of responsibilities of seeing everyone from hip fractures to falls. This is specialist neurophysiotherapy and neuropsychology that really needs to be properly resourced within a neurology centre.
Magdalene Rogers, the Chief Executive of the Neurological Alliance of Ireland, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning. Like many people over the course of the past few weeks, I stayed up to watch the Artemis 2 take off from Cape Canaveral, the Kennedy Space Station there. And I stayed up until the wee small hours 11 days later to watch Artemis 2, the crew module, land in the sea off San Diego and the four astronauts on board return safely to Earth. Now, we all know the first moon landing was carried out by Apollo 11, the giant leap for mankind, which is etched in history forever. But did you know that that journey to the moon had a secret link to Inver? Now, this week on the Greg Hughes podcast, Greg is joined by Dr. Peter Coyle. Now, unlike other people all around the world, he wasn't watching history. He was actually helping to build it, from his work on the space capsule's protection to his journey from Donegal to the heart of the space race. You can hear the incredible story of a local legend, and that's coming up on the Greg Hughes podcast. It will be available on highlandradio.com, on Spotify and on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, from 11 o'clock this morning. And just to give you a sneak preview of what the conversation sounds like, here's a clip of Greg's conversation with Dr. Peter Coyle.
Yeah, just reflecting on that mission as a whole, like, everything was computed, everything was tested, it was all science, it was all effort. It was astonishing to bring so many people together in the way that was done. But it still remains or feels truly remarkable, even so many years, almost a lifetime removed from it. How much of it was just everybody getting absolutely everything right, and how much of it was just a remarkable tailwind that sort of meant that all of the computing came to pass?
Well, let me give you an example there. I'm sorry, editor. They were testing the command module for a different Apollo mission, 7 or 8, I think it was, on the ground. And 3 astronauts were killed in the capsule, the lunar module, on the ground. And the reason they were killed was that the smart guys had decided that the internal part of there was too much oxygen in it, 16 pounds per square inch in the lunar module. And the door opened only from the inside. So you couldn't open it from the outside. So here's an example of where 3 people got killed on the ground because of 2 miscalculations. So they redesigned it and put the door, you could open it from the outside so people could get at it, and they dropped the oxygen down to normal levels. And these things were experiments on the ground where we saw these mistakes being made, you see? But 3 people died on that experiment. So I don't know if that answers it in part.
No, it does. You. It does. It does. And they sacrificing their lives played a crucial part in the whole story as well. I think we could conclude.
Well, you know, the thing that ignited the oxygen in the Apollo 7 or 8 was a bad wire. It wasn't wired properly.
Wow.
So, I mean, we've seen this with Boeing in the last 20 years with some of those big 747s and some of the big planes they're making. Wires that weren't going the right place. I mean, it's so complex, you know, people just suddenly decide that, well, maybe it goes here. That's fatal.
Yeah.
Now, you got to know exactly where it's going.
One of the things about this whole journey for me, which was fascinating, was when the American defense attaché, Colonel Joseph F. O'Connor, traveled all the way to South Donegal to honor your mother, Florence. This was in 1969. Was it the cinema in Donegal Town?
Yes.
It's that as well. I was in there and I never realized this history even existed. Well, he traveled over here to effectively thank her for your work, which I also think is a quite an interesting little thing. Did the penny drop at home, not even outside the family, but with the family, on what you were actually doing over in America? Because, of course, we didn't have video calling. We didn't have the technology we're speaking on right now. I'm not saying you didn't have contact with home, but to have this American land over here and say, you know, Florence, your son's amazing. Look what he's achieved. Like, what was that? What was the reaction in the family or in the community or what?
Well, my family, I'm one of 8 kids, and my family are all, you know, we're all get on very well, and we're accept what the other one's doing or not doing, and we never really, we're very inquisitive about it. And I don't remember anybody clapping me on the back and saying, "You're a hero," something like that. And my poor mother always exaggerated, you know, that I was a genius or I was this or I was that, and I was highly embarrassed. But, you know, the colonel came up and gave her a big, big check. You know, they spent $24 billion by 89 on this program. And I think that's about $215 billion or something in today's dollars. And he gave her the big sum of 40 pounds.
Oh, wow.
Oh, something else.
You know, astonishing, isn't it?
100, I would say.
But I mean, I just, if something like that happened now, and I'm not sure what the media coverage was at the time, but that would be live everywhere. I mean, I, as a journalist in Donegal, this would just have been the biggest story that I could cover. I presume the national media would have been all over it, if not Sky News and every other channel. It's just like, maybe I'm overstating it, but that's how it feels to me, Doctor.
Well, you know, there was no real coverage of it. Nobody stopped me on the street and congratulated me or anything like that. I think so many good Irish people have gone abroad and done well and contributed to many good things. And I think it's accepted, you know. It was like when President Kennedy came back to Ireland and forgotten when that was 62 or something. And I mean, he was a hero, one of the rich, affluent, good-looking, powerful politicians, and he was set up almost as a saint. And I think that's because he was successful, and the Kennedys were successful. And I think all the people staying at home, I mean, I remember when I was at UCD, there was 70 or 80,000 people a year leaving this country.
Yeah.
And we reached a stage where I think there was only 2.8 million people left, or 3.8 million, I can't remember. And so anybody that did anything good or achieved something, I think people here accepted it and for what it was, and they didn't go out making a big issue about it or anything. Could be totally wrong about that. It's just my feeling.
And that was Dr. Peter Coyle, who was working with Dow Chemicals back in the 1960s. He was instrumental in developing a resin. A resin, you ask. What difference did a resin make? Well, I'll tell you what. Had that resin not been wrapped around the capsule as it re-entered the atmosphere, the capsule would have burned up. And Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins would not have made it home. Peter Coyle, instrumental in bringing the three astronauts back from the moon. And that was a huge achievement. And you can listen to that full podcast from 11 o'clock right across our own website and Spotify and iTunes as well. To more mundane matters, but very important matters. Earlier this week, we saw a gorse fire, wildfire, call it what you will, in the vicinity of Knockabrin Hill outside Letterkenny. And last evening, and indeed overnight, we saw similar wildfires break out in North Inishowen in the vicinity of Clonmany and Ballyliffin. We are joined on the programme now by Gary Martin, who is the Director of Human Resources, Economic Development and Emergency Services with Donegal County Council. Gary, a very good morning to you and welcome.
Good morning, Donal.
Gary, I suppose you're always aware when it comes into this time of year. It's April, we start getting a bit of dry weather, there's a lot of gorse out there and the ground starts to dry up, and we did indeed have an orange warning issued by the council through the National Fire Service literally hours before the Knockabrin fire. This is almost predictable, and I'm sure this is something that you and your colleagues are preparing for.
Yeah, it's something we prepare for every year, Donal. The reality is that this time of year, obviously, you know, the ground does start to dry out, thankfully. But what that actually does, it leaves a substantial fire load, basically old grass, undergrowth, moss, heather, whittens and so on and so forth, much more susceptible to fire. And that's why nationally there are orange warnings issued by the Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage every year when weather conditions present, as they are doing now at the moment. And on the back of that, obviously, we prepare our resources across the county, are set up to respond to that. And this week we've seen a number of instances, as you've reflected there. We had one there outside Letterkenny midweek, and then we had a fairly extensive one overnight at Anna and Clonmany as well. And we had a substantial response to that. We had four appliances and over 40 firefighters fighting it from shortly after 8 p.m. last night through to this morning. There's still a number of appliances on the ground there. It's under control, not fully out yet. They're just waiting to get it to a point where they can knock it down safely. But overnight, I just want to commend the crews. Very difficult conditions, very heavy ground to be working in, very, very large scale moss, heather, and wins, and difficult ground to work through and difficult ground to fight back fires. But the important thing, I suppose, to note last night, where the fire started, actually, it did put at risk a number of properties, a number of premises. And the first, I suppose, objective was to try to ensure that they were protected, and using the compressed air foam system that we have, we basically, I suppose, set a cordon around those houses to make sure the fire couldn't spread to them. And thankfully that worked. And it ensured that none of the properties were damaged as a result of that. But a good piece of work overnight by our crews from Cairndona, Buncrana and Moville.
And indeed, we've had a message in from Nancy's Barn in Ballyliff and Nancy's Barn saying a big shout out to all the hard-working firefighters and emergency crews working all night in the Clonmany and Ballyliffin area. Call in for a free tea, coffee and breakfast back this morning. Thank you all sincerely. It's at times like this when you realise how much we need our emergency services, and given that many of the firefighters in this county, Gary, are retained firefighters, and you know, they're not full-time employees, they do other things as well, and they make themselves available and they put themselves on call. It's a huge commitment, and their importance being underlined now this week.
Absolutely. You know, it's like any of the emergency services, you know, whether it's the Gardaí, the HSE, National Ambulance Service or Fire Service, they're there to respond in the event of an incident occurring. And, you know, thankfully you might not see them for long periods of the year, but when you do need them and when you do see them, they are there. And it's a point I just wanted to make as well this morning, you know, just we'll have the opportunity on air. I would really, really, really ask people not to do any burning at this time of year. Legally, you're not supposed to be doing it. But there are temptations for people to maybe try and burn back old grass on the hill, whatever the case may be. There might be people trying to burn old rubbish or old twigs, whatever the case may be. Please, please, please do not do it during this period of heightened weather alert, because as we've seen at a number of instances this week, as I said, we had one in Letterkenny, one in Clonmany overnight, there was another minor one in Cairndona earlier this morning, and then we had one out in Arranmore as well in the last 48 hours. Really, really important that people do not do that. And the other point that I'd really like to make as well is really, really important point, Donal. If someone notices a wildfire, if someone notices a fire starting, don't wait until it expands to a point where it's going to be much more difficult to knock down. At the first opportunity, call 999, call 112, ask for the fire service to be deployed, give the address and we'll respond. You know, there was this fear that whoever calls it in would be charged the bill and all the rest of it. That's not the way the system works. Our objective is to ensure that we protect life and property. Our objective is to ensure that we get out there as quickly as we possibly can. So I would appeal to anyone, if they see anything at all, don't second guess yourself. You know, if in doubt, call the emergency services. We won't give out to you if it turns out to be a false alarm. We won't give out to you if you've done something with good intent. But please, please, please call us at the earliest possible opportunity.
And the other thing is, I mean, in terms of personal responsibility, we all hold a responsibility, not just not to light fires, but I mean, even things as simple as a discarded cigarette butt or a portable barbecue. And I know in the past, portable barbecues have been issues as well. And maybe this is the sort of day and the sort of weekend where you're thinking, oh, maybe it's time to get the charcoal out. And maybe a lot of us will go into our local supermarket and buy one or two of these portable barbecues and have a great barbecue. And with those, very often we may think they're done, we may think they're spent, when the truth is they're not.
Yeah. Look, the reality, Donal, is that most fires are started deliberately. That's the reality of the world that we live in. Now, many of those fires are not malicious and with intent. You know, they're done with good intent. They're just trying to maybe get rid of some rubbish, or they're trying to maybe, as I say, burn the hill to get the grass growing or whatever the case may be. But they're not done with a malicious intent. Some would be a very small number of them. And then, as you say, particularly around bank holiday weekends or when people are out and about going to the beaches, maybe visiting the countryside, people might have barbecues or they might discard flammable materials or whatever the case may be. Again, just think twice. Don't do that, because the damage that this does to our environment and, you know, ground nesting birds at this time of the year, wildlife that are trapped, you know, within fence lines and all the rest of it, it's horrendous. It really, really is horrendous. You know, so this isn't a victimless crime. It's not just the hill that's been burned. You know, it is causing huge damage to our wildlife and causes substantial challenges to ourselves as a fire service and trying to manage them. You know, so look, you know, the key messages are, look, A, don't burn. And secondly, if you see a fire, please call us at the very earliest opportunity at 999 or 112.
And just to confirm that incident on the hill at Anna Clonmany there, it's under control. It's close to being out. There are still units on the ground there. And it's in the final stages. And hopefully that will be damped down in the coming hours and it shouldn't pose any more of a problem. Obviously, you and your colleagues are going to be keeping an eye on the situation, Gary, over the coming days and indeed weeks. But with a reasonably good forecast into the weekend as well, obviously, you know, the message to people is please be very, very careful out there. Gary, all the best to you, and most importantly, all the best to your teams that are out there, and a great big thanks to all of those who worked overnight and continue to work this morning to keep those homes and those individuals in that area safe. Gary, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, General.
Our pleasure. That's Gary Martin there, who is, as we say, Director of Services with Donegal County Council, with responsibility for emergency services. And it's a story that we get every year, that whole issue of gorse fires and wildfires. And it always does seem to be around this kind of late April into early May when it happens, and the weather at the moment is absolutely prime weather for this to happen. Just want to take a few of your comments before we go for a break. Caller says, with regards to Senator Eileen Flynn, I feel sorry for the Senator. No one deserves abuse, but people were entitled to complain as she accused all who waved the flag as far right and fearful. There is a big difference between debate and insult and hatred. And I think this is where we're coming in here. Another comment, it says, it's amazing watching what's unfolding in front of our eyes and ears. The protesters had great support and coverage. It's so blatantly obvious now that the propaganda machine has kicked in to blacken they and anyone who attended or waved a flag. Couldn't let it be seen that the people were united. The response to that, caller, is quite simple. And the response is that the vitriol that has been placed under what Senator Flynn said was vitriol. It was vitriol. It goes way beyond comment. It goes way beyond debate. Absolutely. Anything that Senator Flynn says is open to debate. Anything that a politician says is open to argument. It's open to reasoned debate. It's open to argument. And it is absolutely the right of everybody to challenge what somebody says. Absolutely. You can challenge what Senator Flynn says. You can challenge what I say. You can challenge what anyone says. That's absolutely our right and is fundamental to involvement in a democracy. However, when you get to a point that it goes beyond reasoned debate and goes into areas of vitriol, hate and perceived threat, that is a whole new different ballgame. I want to tell you, a Revolut card was found on Thursday in the Calahame mountaintop area of Letterkenny. If you believe that Revolut card may have been yours, I'm going to give you a number you can call. It's 086-398-4802. That's 086-398-4802 if you believe that a Revolut card found in the Calahame mountaintop area of Letterkenny may be yours. I want to go to line one because we're joined by Will Mitchell, who is a waste prevention officer with My Waste. Will, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
We're hearing a lot today about a new campaign to help retailers take the final step in fully removing 10 banned single-use plastics from the sale and supply chain. Single-use plastics, it's been one of the big debates of the current era. How close are we to fundamental change?
Very close. This campaign is really about getting the last few remaining retailers to check their stocks by downloading our free toolkit on mywaste.ie/SUP and just check stocks and make sure that none of these 10 banned items have found their way through. So what we found with our research is that behavior is actually ahead of awareness. So while only 50% of the businesses that we surveyed were aware of the regulations banning these particular 10 banned items, that only 4% are still supplying them. So we're really close to getting rid of these.
And in terms of these items, tell us what they are. Give us an indication so that, you know, that we may recognise them when we're next in our shop.
Sure. It's a list of 10. So it's single-use plastic cutlery, cotton buds, chopsticks, drink stirrers, polystyrene food and drinks containers, plates, balloon rods, straws, and all oxo-degradable plastics. Now, if any of those don't mean anything to you, again, if you visit mywaste.ie/SUP, there are pictures of them there.
Yeah, and of course, we're all used now at this point, if we're buying coffee at a petrol station or whatever, the stirrers almost inevitably now are wooden. And that's obviously absolutely fine, that is compostable, etc. It's when it used to be the old plastic stirrers, if I recall correctly, there used to be a little hole at the bottom of them as well to assist with the stirring. Haven't seen that for a long time, I'm glad to say. So they're the items we need to be looking out for. In terms of sanction, there's not been a lot of talk about sanctions against premises or businesses that still offer them and still use them. Is it time perhaps to, in certain cases, move perhaps away from the carrot and more toward the stick?
I think there's value to both. There are fines that, there are potential fines for those bringing SUPs, these banned single-use plastics, into the country. Perhaps that's something that could be brought in and looked at a little bit more. Yep, but as I said, this campaign is really about making sure that the retailers use our free toolkit to make sure that they're not stocking them and supplying them.
And you're embarking on a publicity campaign as of today to really bring this into the public consciousness. So presumably we can expect to see newspaper advertisements, radio advertisements, whatever, social media clips as well, that's going to bring this into the public focus, and more perhaps it's going to make us aware of the situation and what can be done.
That's right. Yeah, we're very much focused on the retailer side of things this time. And thankfully we have great support from industry bodies. So IBEX, CSNA, Retail Excellence Ireland and RG Data are all encouraging their members to download and use our toolkit.
Is there a reluctance on the part of people to mention this if they're in a premises? And it almost goes back to that there's an old thing about the Irish would never send back a meal in a restaurant or would never complain about a meal in a restaurant. Are we equally reluctant to perhaps say to somebody in a premises, if we come across this banned single-use plastic, to go, excuse me, are you aware of that? Or is there more? Should there be more impetus on us as citizens to actually be more proactive and say it?
Well, I think you're right on both counts there. I think there is probably a reluctance for anybody to speak up and say, oh, by the way, did you know you shouldn't be doing this? I think that's innate in all of us. But likewise, we should be taking that step because the vast majority of us are trying to avoid these single-use plastics. And the vast majority of us are concerned about climate change and environmental protection. So it is definitely time to speak up when we do see these instances.
Will Mitchell, Waste Prevention Officer with My Waste. As we said, that campaign is being launched today, backed by Retail Ireland, CSNA, Retail Excellence Ireland and RG Data. It's supporting retailers in completing the transition away from those 10 banned single-use plastic items. We can expect to see a lot more about this in the coming days. But for now, Will, thank you very much indeed. Everyone is being invited to fondly remember through song and prayer the O'Donnell family, Sharon, Joanne, Adrian, Kevin and their babysitter Noreen. Their 40th anniversary mass will take place in St Julian's Cathedral at 4 o'clock on tomorrow Saturday, and a remembrance concert supported by the town choirs on Sunday afternoon with special guests at 3 o'clock in St Julian's Cathedral, followed by refreshments in Scoilwerrigan-Small, and all are welcome. I also want to just mention, before we go to Shannon for the Scroll Patrol, Highland Radio Bingo jackpot now sitting at €15,800. Books only €5 each can be bought at stores all over the country or here at Highland Radio. And recent wins with books bought in Maple Castle, Finn, Lunchbox, Buncrana, Ivan Brown's in Manor Cunningham, Barclays, Ruffaut, Supervalue, Buncrana, Mace in Kilmacrennan and Callaghan's in Newton Cunningham. So winners all over the county. Now let's go over and say good morning to Shannon Wilkin. Shannon, how are you?
How are you?
I'm excellent. Thank you very much indeed. Let's talk about what's making the news in social media this week. And we start with Justin Bieber.
So Justin Bieber has had a bit of a revival recently. He featured at Coachella and everyone was calling it Bieber-chella. He's reflected a lot recently on growing up in the spotlight, his mental health journey, all that. But he's got a beautiful song out at the moment called Hallelujah. And it has lyrics in it for being thankful for his mom, his family, all that. So what people are doing online is using this audio and telling people what they're thankful for. So, Donal, what's your hallelujah? What are you thankful for?
What am I thankful for? I am thankful for health, and I'm thankful for the weather, and I am thankful for the fact that we're able to sit here and talk about Justin Bieber.
Yep, exactly. It's a simple thing. So if everyone wants to reflect today on
this what I presume is different to Leonard Cohen. Song, the Hallelujah song by Leonard Cohen.
It's different.
A different song, yeah. That's grand. Talk to me. Oh, that's very different to Leonard Cohen.
Yeah.
The Coachella thing. I did see some commentary on the Coachella thing that people felt it was a bit of a lazy performance. He just turned up and just did a bit and then left. They were expecting, I think, a bit more.
Yeah, so apparently he was reading off a YouTube screen the whole time, but then I saw other people defending Justin that because he didn't own his own music back in the day, he was using his own music that he'd reproduced. So that's kind of where that came from. But yeah, not much of a performance. I heard a lot of people say as well, Sabrina Carpenter didn't give a lot of energy to her performances. Yeah. It was like she didn't really want to be there. It was half an effort.
Interesting. So Justin doesn't own his own stuff. That happened to Taylor Swift, didn't it? And then she re-recorded everything. So you're now supposed to buy the Taylor version of what she's done.
Yeah, Taylor's album.
And Taylor's versions have now made her the most streamed artist of all time.
Yeah, this was actually a funny one. I was looking through a list of the songs that are the most streamed. So in the top 20, the lowest year I could find was the year 2000. So that was Yellow by Coldplay. And Chris Martin was actually sitting in a studio in Wales and he was just, oh my goodness, what am I going to write about? And he saw the Yellow Pages and apparently that's where it all came from.
Great song.
But it made me think as well, if we looked back on the most popular songs of all time that you've like heard, I wonder what would make it. I think Fleetwood Mac would definitely be there. Bruce Springsteen. What else do you think?
I would say Queen, Bohemian Rhapsody would be there.
Definitely.
Now you're going to get your classics. Your Elton John's going to inevitably be there. Your Beatles are going to be there. If you were looking at songs, Bohemian Rhapsody is the one I would say, the song I would like, that I would expect most to be there. Possibly Fleetwood Mac's Go Your Own Way. But then again, when you come to an artist like Fleetwood Mac, they have so many songs, everyone's going to have a sort of a favourite Fleetwood Mac song. For me, it's either Go Your Own Way or The Chain. For you, it might be Songbird. For somebody else, it might be Little Lies. Somebody else, it could be Tusk. It could be anything. There's so many to choose from.
There was a lot of Fleetwood Mac stuff has been back in the media as well. Again, they take the audio and they put it on TikTok. So you'll never get away from the sound of the woman that loves you. You know, Stevie Nicks, whenever she sang that. So they've been doing that with like every character ever. So they've done one for Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio. They're saying that that's why he's such a womanizer, because he loved her the whole time and he never got over it.
But aren't we at the point now where hits are going to be dependent on TikTok, social media? I mean, I remember Kate Bush's Running Up That Hill became huge for a while again, and it turned out that was because it featured in Stranger Things. And perhaps the single biggest sort of use of that, where something's used in media, is I remember when I was in the 80s, I was working on a pirate radio station in Waterford, and there was a band called Journey, and they had two songs that we used to play a bit because they were a bit popular, but they never really went on air anywhere. One was called Who's Crying Now? The other one was called Don't Stop Believing. And I've been aware of Don't Stop Believing as a song for 40 years. And then Sopranos, closing scene, Journey's Don't Stop Believing gets played over it, and suddenly Don't Stop Believing is now one of the biggest songs in the world of all time.
Yeah,
and that's totally Dancing Sopranos.
It's everyone's karaoke song as well, isn't it? Even though nobody can actually hit the notes.
I would not chance that in a million years. We tried singing it with the ukulele orchestra once, and believe you me, Shannon, we will never try that again. Shannon, I am afraid, and I know we wanted to talk about the Kardashians and Katy Perry. We don't have time because time has totally caught up on me, and I really do apologise for that, Shannon, because there was just so much on the programme today. We're going to have to cut it there because we have come to the end of the show. Thank you, Shannon, for everything you've
done. Thank you, Donal.
Thank you, everything you've done today and this week as well, because you've been instrumental in making sure that I didn't make a complete dog's dinner of this. Caroline, as ever, fantastic, produced, looked after me. And to you, Caroline, thanks as well. Greg's back on Monday. John's up next around the Northwest. For myself, Donal Kavanagh, have a great day.